Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. This is episode 162. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. In the news, I'm almost done with the first episode of the Masonic Radio Theater. Stay tuned for the updates and check out the Facebook page for that for a little bit more information as it develops. I wanted to mention that the next episode of the Masonic Roundtable will be all about the 33rd degree. You're not going to want to miss it. It just happens to be episode 33. Right into the paper for the week. The paper that I have for you this week is one which deals with some things that are traditional in the York Rite of Masonry. It's called the Mason's Mark. I hope you enjoy. And Brother Juan Sepulveda, if you're listening, this one's kind of for you, buddy. And if you don't know why I'm dedicating this paper to Brother Juan Sepulveda, it's because Brother Juan just became companion Juan Sepulveda. He has just gone through his York Rite degrees. So huge congratulations to Brother Juan Sepulveda for taking a further step in Masonry. The Mason's Mark by Wallace M. Gage, Past Master, the Main Lodge of Research. A recent tour of England and Scotland includes visits to the beautiful and stately Salisbury Cathedral, York Minster, Westminster Abbey, and to Roslyn Chapel and Melrose Abbey. All had many quote-unquote Mason's Marks carved in the stones and can be found in many other buildings still standing in Europe and the British Isles. These old Mason's Marks help us to trace Freemasonry's story from its early operative days to the present, when it is used in a symbolic sense in the first of capitular degrees of the York Rite. Putting aside the legends from the old Gothic constitutions perpetuated in our present-day rituals, which purport to trace Masonry from the building of King Solomon's Temple to Noah's Flood or to Cain and Abel, Masonic studies in the last century or so have been able to document fairly accurately the evolution of Freemasonry as far back as the mid-14th century, when the first attempt was made to organize the Masons' trade in England and to establish work rules for its government. Our modern Freemasonry is an outgrowth of those operative Masons in the Middle Ages, the builders of those ornate and beautiful examples of the Gothic school of architecture unsurpassed in the builder's art. The Mason's Mark has been found on structures far older than these, however, some going back to 2500 BC. Little attention was paid to these carvings until 1841, when a British archaeologist published an article on his studies. Masonic students took an interest in the subject and parceled the link formed between operative and speculative Masonry. It is surprising how long a thing may remain unnoticed until it has been discovered. When a number of Mason's Marks were pointed out to an old priest, he remarked, quote, "I have walked through this church 4 times a day, 28 times a week, and never noticed one of them. Now I cannot look anywhere but they flit into my eyes," end quote. The operative Mason's Mark was used for purely practical purposes. During the period when most cathedrals, abbeys, and monasteries were built, there were few who could read or write. When he became a fellow craft or a journeyman, each Mason selected his mark or design, which was his for life, and was never to be changed. The mark thus served as a signature. He cut it into each stone he prepared so that he might be given credit and receive wages for his labor, and also be held responsible for the quality and proper execution of the work. The Mason's Mark has a similar objective to trademark by assigning responsibility for quality work. During the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church dominated the religious scene in Europe and Britain, and most of the work done by operative Masons of the day was constructed of cathedrals, abbeys, and monasteries for the church. With the coming of the Protestant Reformation in 1517, however, the Roman Church lost much of its temporal power and influence, and the building of religious works fell off sharply. The operative Masons found themselves facing increased unemployment. Fewer apprentices were accepted to learn the trade, and work for the Masons left was limited largely to military construction and repair work requiring lesser skills. This period of operative decline was the beginning of a gradual change from guilds of builders to moral and philosophical fraternity, which today we call speculative Masonry. Returning our attention to the Mason's Mark, we find an early reference to it in the German Torgau Statutes of 1462. They note that on becoming a journeyman, equivalent of the fellowcraft, the Mason took his mark at the solemn admission feast. Later in Scotland, in 1598, the so-called Shaw Statutes were placed in effect. A set of rules governing the operative Mason's trade were issued by William Shaw, master of the work of King James VI of Scotland. These contain the first known references to the Mason's Mark in the English/Scottish area from whence our present-day Freemasonry has descended. These statutes say, quote, that no master or fellow or craft be received or admitted without there being 6 masters and 2 entered apprentices present, the warden of that lodge being one of the 6, and that the day of the receiving of the said fellow of craft or master be properly booked and his name and mark inserted in said book." End quote. These newly passed fellow craft had to pay the lodge, quote, 1 Scots mark for each registration. The fellow craft was journeyman, fully qualified to do mason's work, and the master was a contractor or employer of fellow crafts, and who could take apprentices for training. In 1634, an event took place which was to profoundly affect the future, of the craft. The minutes of the Scottish Lodge of Edinburgh at Mary's Chapel for July 1st, 1634, notes that Lord Alexander, Viscount Canada, Sir Anthony Alexander, and Sir Alexander Strachan, Bart, were admitted members of the lodge. This is the earliest record of the admission of non-operatives into a lodge in Scotland or England, and it turned out to be the opening wedge in the transition from operative to speculative masonry. The earliest minutes of the lodge are dated July 31st, 1599, and show the mason's mark used in conjunction with the signature of one of the members present. By the following year, many marks appear in the minutes, sometimes unaccompanied by a signature. Minutes of other Scottish lodges also show the use of the mark, undoubtedly in conformance with Shaw Statute's requirement. Following the admission of the 3 non-operatives noted above, the practice spread rapidly. In a period of decline for operatives, more and more non-operatives came to be accepted as members by most lodges, and the character of masonry underwent increasing rapid change. By 1670, for example, the lodge at Aberdeen shows minutes signed by some 49 members, about 3/4 of whom were non-operatives. Noteworthy was the fact that all but 2 had marks shown beside their names, indicating that the practice of choosing a mark was not restricted to the operatives. During this period, when activities are well documented in Scotland, English records are scarce regarding acceptance of non-operatives and make no reference at all to use of the mason's mark. The dearth of records makes it difficult to do more than guess at the chain of events which immediately preceded the most important event of all, formation of the first Grand Lodge by 4 old lodges in London in 1717, generally accepted as the historical dividing line between operative and speculative masonry. It established the basis of organizational pattern, followed by all regular Masonic jurisdictions everywhere. Ireland followed suit, forming its own Grand Lodge in 1725, and Scotland likewise in 1736. At that time, English lodges were almost entirely made up of non-operatives, while in Scotland the operatives were still strong, but waning rapidly. Ritual played a relatively minor part in operative masonry, but with the transition to speculative, it developed and expanded, and soon came to play an important role. We know little of it until the publication of the first of many exposés in 1724. None of them had anything to say about the mason's mark, and the first indication we have of a ceremony or degree being connected with it is in the September 1st, 1769 minutes of Phoenix Royal Arch Chapter of Plymouth, England, where it states that 6 members were made quote-unquote mark masons and mark master masons, and each chose their mark. Well, the mark had been used in Scotland for many years. The first time we hear of its ceremonial aspect is in the records of St. John Operative Lodge, Banff, on July 7, 1778. There is a strong evidence that the mark degree was worked in America as early as 1782, although documentary proof is lacking. The development of the mark master degree to its present day status is a story in itself. At various times, it has been conferred in craft lodges by Scottish Rite, by Royal Arch Chapters, by Templar encampments, and by independent mark lodges. In America, the degrees were gradually absorbed by the Royal Arch early in the 19th century. Over the years, there have been other degrees based on the mark, such as Markman, Mark and Link, Fugitive Mark, Black Mark, and others, but these have disappeared, leaving only the Mark Master Mason. Although the rituals vary somewhat in different jurisdictions, they are basically similar. As the ritual of the Mark Master Mason degree developed, the Mason's mark came to take a somewhat subordinate role to the keystone and the theme of the building of King Solomon's Temple. The mark degree now is a requirement for candidates for the Royal Arch degree in the United States, Ireland, and Scotland. The United Grand Lodge of England at one time voted to recognize the mark degree as a graceful addition to the fellow craft degree, but soon reversed itself, which led to the formation of the Grand Lodge of Mark Master Masons of England, Wales, and the dominions and dependencies of British Crown. In 1856, which today has some 1,200 mark lodges under its jurisdiction, only in Scotland is the mark degree recognized as part of the craft masonry. It may be, and usually is, conferred on master masons in the symbolic lodge. It is also a requirement for the Royal Arch degree, and the degree may be conferred in the Royal Arch chapter if the candidate has not already received it in his lodge. Our ritual for the three craft degrees is clearly based on the practices of operative masonry, with symbolic usage of the working tools, the ashlars, the trestle board, lessons in architecture, and many others. Why the mason's mark, an operative practice from the time immemorial, should have been omitted in favor of such things as the anchor and the ark, beehive, etc., is difficult to understand. A possible explanation may be that most of those who composed our early ritual were English, who may well have been unaware of the mark in the operative scheme of things. Only in Scotland has it received recognition and been given its rightful place as part of craft masonry. Our mason's mark is a Masonic equivalent of our signature. It represents our name, our character, our integrity, and our skills. When we sign our name or apply our mark to a document, letter, painting, or to a stone for the building of the cathedral, we stand up to be counted. By it, we say, in effect, quote, "This is where I stand, this is my work. I guarantee its quality, and I am proud of the workmanship it shows." In addition to our own mason's mark, we have a responsibility in regard to the best-known mason's mark of them all, the square and compasses. Almost all of us wear it, or otherwise display it, thus identifying ourselves as masons to all we come into contact with. In doing so, we cannot help but project an image of masonry to the public. When we wear this mason's mark, the square and compasses, the world will judge the craft by our words and actions. Should we feel unable to live up to those tenets and principles that Freemasonry stands for, we would be well advised to leave the Masonic ring or pin on the dresser, rather than damage the good name of the fraternity. It seems to be human nature for us to want to leave some sort of memorial, that future generations will know we passed this way. We find this in the graffiti scrawled on the walls of Pompeii and in ancient Egypt, and on the subway cars in modern cities. It shows in the initials carved in the old school desks, and in the John Loves Mary cut into the tree trunks, and in the Kilroy Was Here of World War II. We sometimes hear it said of a person that, quote, "he left his mark," meaning he made a lasting impression on some institution or field of endeavor. Yet there are varying kinds of marks left. George Washington and Thomas Edison most certainly left their marks on our society and civilization, but so did Hitler and Stalin. All of us can't be Washingtons or Edisons, but we can contribute toward the building of a better world. Our ancient operative ancestor, in cutting his mark on a stone for Salisbury Cathedral, left a memorial which says, quote, "I had a part in building this beautiful house of God," end quote. By being better citizens, better husbands, better fathers, we can leave our mark on society by discharging our responsibilities to God, to our country, to our neighbor, and to ourselves. In our vocations, in our daily lives, and in our dealings with our fellow man, let's do our best to leave our marks only on quote-unquote good work, true work, square work, just such work as is wanted for the building of the temple. All right, so again, I hope you guys enjoyed that piece. Maybe it gave you a little bit further insight into the York Rite side of things. And again, Brother Juan, congratulations on getting your capitular degrees. Now comes the time I ask you to support the show, whether it's through the apps for Windows, Apple, or Android. You can get those on our website at wcypodcast.com, or you can check out the links to donate via PayPal. You pick the amount, whether it's $1 or $2. It doesn't really matter. Whatever you want to donate to the show, it just helps keep those lights on and keeps this computer running and recording. Another way you can contribute is by go ahead and spending $2.99, or it might be $3.99, I can't remember. But either way, it's a wonderful book. It's called Tales from the Craft. If you follow me on Facebook, or if we're friends on Facebook, I post quotes from this book all day long, probably 3 or 4 times a week. It's a fantastic book, and it's only a couple bucks. And Brother Steve Harrison is so generous that he's donating a little bit of money from each sale to this show. And I'm taking that money, and I'm splitting it 50-50 with the Masonic Roundtable to help them out with our costs there also. Then there are two other ways you can help support the show. Both are shopping. The first is onnit.com, which is a bunch of really good, healthy living stuff. So if you want to check that out, go to onnit.com or go to wcypodcast.com, click support the show, and click through our links to Onnit. That'll help out. Additionally, when you check out, you're going to get 10% off if you use the coupon code WCY. And of course, as Freemasons, we love anything Masonic, but it's even better if it's quality made, handcrafted stuff. And that's just what you're going to get if you go to freemasonryart.com. Again, this is by Brother Juan Sepulveda, who I mentioned in the show earlier. Brother Juan is the host of the Winding Stairs podcast. He's also the guy behind freemasonryart.com, and he's also a co-host on the Masonic Roundtable. He's a fantastic gentleman. His works speak for themselves. I urge you, I don't even want to tell you how awesome stuff is. Just go to the website and look at it. You'll see. It's great stuff. Again, if you see something that you like, and I know you will, use the checkout code WCY. That'll get you 10% off, and Brother Juan will send a little bit of love this way also. All right, so one of the things that we talked about in the last few weeks, in masonry we have stuff called working tools, whether that's the 24-inch gauge, the common gavel, the square, the compasses, all these different things. We read a paper a few weeks back about how the 24-inch gauge might have a possible connection to the circadian rhythm in humans. We talked about the compasses and perhaps its connection with the part of the brain related to making decisions. So there are these symbols we use in masonry that somehow might scientifically connect to our minds or psyches or parts of our body. So for instance, this week I wanted to talk about the square. The square, we say, is to remind us that we should be fair all the time, and to emulate the square in our actions should be just, and we should support all of the things in our life that hold us up, like our family, our country, our God, and our neighbors. But what about its relation to the human body? Does this relate to fairness, or rather more than that, perhaps to some force which gives us the ability to manage our devotions to the aforementioned responsibilities, neighbors, family, God, and country? I'm not really sure on this one. If you guys would like, I'd invite you to weigh in on the Facebook page or on Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter at WhenceCameYou. And of course, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/WCY podcast. But hit me up on one of those two social media sites and let me know what you think. Let's expound some ideas. Next is this week's famous Freemason, Lawrence Dale Bell, or Larry Bell. Born April 5th, 1894, and he passed away in 1956, just before Halloween on October 20th. He was an American industrialist and a founder of Bell Aircraft Corporation. Bell was born in Mentone, Indiana, and he lived there until 1907 when his family moved to Santa Monica, California. He joined his older brother Grover and stunt pilot Lincoln Beachy as a mechanic in 1912. Grover Bell was killed in a plane crash the following year, and Lawrence vowed to quit aviation for good. However, he went to work for Glenn L. Martin Company after friends convinced him to return to the industry. He became Martin's shop foreman at age 20 and later the company's general manager, wanting to become partner. He left Martin in 1928. He joined Consolidated Aircraft in Buffalo, New York, eventually becoming vice president and general manager. When Consolidated relocated to San Diego, Bell stayed in Buffalo and founded his own company with 56 employees, Bell Aircraft Corporation, on July 10, 1935. On a government-sponsored quote-unquote spy tour to Germany with 44 other industrialists in 1938, he saw the FW-61 helicopter and used the layout of a German aircraft factory for his Niagara Falls plant. Bell Aircraft built the P-39 and the P-63 fighter aircrafts during World War II. Their P-59 fighter was America's first jet-powered aircraft. Post-war, the company produced the Bell X-1, the first aircraft to break the sound barrier in level flight. The company began developing helicopters in 1941, with the Bell 30 taking its maiden flight in 1943. This early model evolved into the Bell 47, one of the most recognizable aircrafts in history. For his role in the X-1's first supersonic flight, he shared the 1947 Collier Trophy with pilot Chuck Yeager and John Stack, a research scientist with the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, now NASA. He was awarded the Society of Automotive Engineers, Daniel Gunningham Medal 1944, and was posthumously inducted into the National Aviation Hall of Fame in 1977, the Army Aviation Hall of Fame 1986, and the International Aerospace Hall of Fame in 2004. That's it this week. It was a little bit shorter of an episode, but I hope you enjoyed it just the same. Please find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Whence Came You. Check us out on Google Plus at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com. That's also where you can write me, and I will always personally respond to your emails. It might take a little while. I get a little bit backed up. My work schedule is a little crazy right now, but just the same, I'd invite you. I'd love to hear from you guys. Please check out the Midnight Freemasons, which comes out on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We have great content there every week. Please check out the Masonic Roundtable, which airs at 10, 9 Central on Tuesday nights. It's live on Google Hangouts and on YouTube. Please check out the Working Tools Magazine if you really like the Midnight Freemasons, or if you like great Masonic content in general. The Working Tools Magazine is a great place to get a lot of that. And that's twtmag.com. Several options for subscriptions, whether it's digital, iPad, the newsstand, you can get it PDF, you can get a real print copy. It's awesome. It's the largest independent Masonic magazine in the United States. And last but not least, please check out the Masonic Radio Theater. I should have the episode done by the end of this month, by the end of September. Masonic Radio Theater is a throwback to the 1930s and 20s and even some early 1940s radio dramas. And these are going to be radio dramas played out by different actors. I've compiled the recordings from around the country. I'm putting them together in one story, and it's called The Craftsman. It's a mystery of sorts. It is a detective story. You want to put yourself back in the 1930s, and it's really kind of a noir detective story. It's really cool. Like I said, the talent is amazing. We've got Masons doing all the parts. My wife is in it even. I needed a lady for one of the parts, and she did a fantastic job. But in any case, you guys got to check it out. I hope you are excited about it as I am, and I will continue to tell you more on our Facebook page and keep you guys up to date. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.